Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 168 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday again, Larry. It seemed like I couldn't get anybody else to join us, so I had to get you back again.
That's really sad.
But really, you're the best we got, and but legit, Larry, you are the best we got, and it's pretty damn good, I would have to say. I bet you if we unmuted Brenda's microphone, she's not here at the moment, she would probably agree with us.
Well, she's going to be with us later. We're going to bring her in to just a tad bit on that letter that we've discussed, a similar letter previously. But yes, we're going to have her.
She may have mentioned something to that, but you hadn't said anything to me about it before. But okay. So I need ample cue time to remind her to come on over when it is that time.
Sure thing.
But first of all, hey, like and subscribe and share this on YouTube and all of the podcast apps and all the other places. Tell us what's going on tonight, Larry.
Yeah, and if you don't hit that YouTube like button, we are going to disconnect you from our side.
Where did you get that from?
Oh, that was from Neil Bortz.
He was entertaining.
Yes, he got his start in talk radio in Atlanta, Georgia, for those who have never heard of him, on a talk radio station called WRNG Ring Radio. And the host of a show, a program on Ring Radio, abruptly died. Oops. And Neil Bortz showed up to see the station manager, and he said, "I would like to take that prime drive slot." And the station manager said, "I don't think so."
he ended up on a pretty high power station in Atlanta, and coincidentally towards roughly the middle of my little vacation, I just happened to be able to pick it up one day, because it's really hard to pick up stations, particularly AM during the day. And I picked it up, and it was his final day. He was like, "Well, I'm off the air, guys. Take care. Bye. Peace out."
Yes, he actually went from WRNG to WSB, Welcome South, brother.
Okay, WSB.
50,000 watts. And then they went into what do they call it, syndication, when they distributed it. He had a couple hundred stations, not anything like Rush, but he had a respectable sized network. But he was the one who told his unhappy listeners, "If you don't like us, go to the radio, retrieve the numbers and let us know, and we'll disconnect you from this side."
And truth be told, Larry, if we really wanted to a certain degree, you could circumvent it, but I could cut you off from our end. I can block you. So better watch yourself.
So
what do we have going on?
Well, we have two questions from the inside. These come from people who are serving time. And we have a comment from a listener, I think he's not a listener, but a transcript reader. And we have a plethora of clips tonight. I went clip crazy this week. So we got video clips.
Yeah, this is a clip-a-rama.
And some of them are current events, and some of them go back to the 1940s. That I'm setting the table for bringing back Harry Truman in a future episode. But I didn't want to put the clip in tonight, but I'm letting people become familiar with Harry Truman, former president Harry Truman.
Because people don't know who that is.
There are a lot of people who've never heard the name Harry Truman. And then we're going to be talking about a case out of the Pennsylvania. It's an important case dealing with PFRs and being held up on parole because of housing. And that's going to be a great topic to discuss.
Excellent. Excellent. I guess then I will run off to question number one.
All right.
And I don't have it up on the screen, but it says, "Dear Mr. Larry, why do you think the Federal Bureau of Prisons can do anything they want to an inmate? Our mailroom has denied my religious material. I'm going through the administrative process and ask why you wish to violate my First Amendment rights and my religious right to a Bible study through any minister through the mail. Now, another issue, back in October of 2020, a federal judge ordered the U.S. Treasury Department and the IRS to make federal stimulus payment to people in prison plus jail. I did mine on October 13th, 2020, mailed it out, and for the $1,200 stimulus check 5 months ago, and it's still not here. Also, there was another $600 stimulus that was filed for and that passed in December 2020. I put in for that in January 2021. As we were told, and some inmates got their $600 before the $1,200, and many are still in the post office in Texas. All I can do about that is wait and see if it hits my account. I believe the IRS is still blocking inmates from getting the stimulus checks. I don't have anyone our way to look into this. I still have no money on my account, and I know that my subscription is running out. I don't know if you can do anything, and I would hope that you can, and any help that you have, please, and thank you. That's a kind of neat question, and there's more money on the way, isn't there?
Yeah, I believe there will be. I don't know that I've indicated that they can do anything they want to prisoners or probationers, and I'd like to clear that up. They can't do anything they want. They can do an awful lot of things to both prisoners and probationers because of the deferential treatment that courts afford correctional facility managers. That doesn't mean that you have no rights, but it's kind of like a kid in school. And I know I'm going to get hate mail for making the comparison, but kids do not have the same rights as adults. When they're in school, they're minors. Well, when you're serving prison time, you have a very diminished amount of rights, but you still do have some. Yeah, would you agree you've been in prison? Would you agree that you had a limited right to privacy?
Limited. I would say that it was extremely limited.
Would you agree that you had a limited right to access people of your choosing to acquaint yourself with while you were in prison?
Absolutely. Especially on the outside. Yes, you had to fill out all kinds of paperwork to say I'd like to have this person, and then they verified them.
Well, and see, those things are done in the interest of, quote, institutional security. And a judge with a black robe is not going to come in and second guess institutional security in most circumstances. So therefore, the prison administrators get a lot of deference, and they deserve a lot of deference because running a prison is a very tough job. And I admit that freely. It's like running a small city of people who don't want to be there. Most people that are there would probably prefer another housing option.
And yes,
You've got a lot of things and a lot of moving parts to running a prison. If we went through all the things that are required to administer a prison, you don't even think about them because they just automatically happen. So it's a tough job. They do get a lot of deference. But in terms of some rights, you do have the right. I mean, if the courts have been deferential on many things, but in terms of your right to worship, prisons have to make accommodations for those things. But he doesn't have the rights that he would have if he were on the street as a non-convicted person. And I'm sorry, but that's the reality of the situation. But in terms of the stimulus payments, this was the previous administration that without it being expressed in Congress, by the will of Congress, that people not receive those payments, they decided on their own. And that's why it's important when you elect an administration, they're running the day-to-day affairs of government. And they decided to take that and to suppress and to try to prevent prisoners from getting those payments. The courts have not been favorable, to my knowledge, in terms of because Congress is the final say-so, and they did not prohibit prisoners from having, if you were otherwise qualified for those payments, you're supposed to receive them. Now, unfortunately, here's the sad thing about it is when you eventually get those payments, particularly in the state systems, not as much in the federal systems, but in the state systems, they have a way of taking your money from you for unpaid things. Sick call, for example.
Correct.
You'll have an accrued bill for sick call. You'll have accrued bill for restitution. And in some state statutory schemes, they have an automatic withholding of a certain percentage of anything that's put on your books to meet your obligations of your conviction. You know, all those, that whole list of fees that they assess. When you look at your conviction, when you do a plea, there's a list. In some states, it's a very lengthy list of things. And all those run hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And you'll end up possibly losing a significant amount of the money but I believe you'll eventually get the stimulus payment. And if you'll make sure that I have this letter back in my file, because I'm not seeing it, I'll make sure that we extend his subscription until this is resolved, because we don't want him to lose connection with the newsletter. That's one of the lifelines that people look forward to that are serving time, is that someone's out there at least doing something, trying to change what they're facing when they get out.
All righty then. What about the religious side of that part? I remember somebody while I was gone who was Catholic, and he was trying to get he was trying to get wine brought in to do communion, which I thought was hilarious. I just didn't see that was ever going to happen, and he would file grievances left and right. You have that First Amendment right, and they have been not necessarily with people that are in prison. I think the Supreme Court has been pretty much in favor of however you want to worship, you get to worship that way.
I know our state Supreme Court has been very, very accommodating to people and their religious beliefs. They get to do a little smoking here. What is one of the religious things, particularly in the Native American population. I forget what they call that. Right. Yeah, so they.
But what I know it as is like this is going to. Like, I don't know of any other word on how to say this. So just whatever. Peace pipe. Is that what you're sort of referring to? I know that's going to come across terrible.
No, I don't think that's what they call it, but yeah.
I don't think it is either.
But
I'm going to get hate mail.
Yeah, you have a way of doing that.
I know. Clearly, because we have that coming up, I think, next.
So
sweat lodges? Is it wampum? Yep. People in chat are giving me choices here. I don't know. Wampum or sweat lodges?
So.
I don't know which answer this is. But anyway, okay, so. Not the one that I picked.
So, if the prison can assert a legitimate security concern with what you're proposing to do, if and I don't know of any such religion that builds bonfires, but I have a feeling, that the courts would probably say, no, you don't get to do that, because that would jeopardize institutional security, and the courts are very deferential to the need to keep a prison secure. The prisons are supposed to be secure places to the extent they can be. It's hard to have workers want to work in a prison if they're not secure, and people are being sentenced to confinement, not to the loss of their life or their limbs. So it's our duty to keep those institutions as safe as they can be.
And as another example, if I'm not mistaken, this happened after I left, that the Muslim community filed grievances, and I don't know if they went through actual legal challenges, that they be allowed to grow beards. And Georgia has a deal where you have to shave, and they give out razors and all that garbage. But so then next thing I know, people have beards in Georgia prisons, and I'm pretty sure that was, and they can't just say if you have to claim to be a Muslim to do it. They would just have to let everybody do it.
So peyote, that's what I'm looking for.
Oh,
but can be smoked by rolling it into marijuana leaf or tobacco. The powder is referred to as a, I don't even know how to read this stuff, but anyway, that's what I was trying to think of.
That's fine. Okay. Question number two then, I think you said in pre-show that this is a follow-up to something we covered a handful of episodes back.
Yes.
It says, to the Larianator, I'm writing in regards to a question that you addressed in episode 165 of your podcast recorded on 2/13/21 regarding the possibility of parole being brought back to the feds. I just wish to make a rebuttal. I do not need a reply. You stated about how the American public would be whipped into a frenzy about people not paying their debt to society if parole existed in the federal system. However, I would just like to point out that most every state prisoner has the possibility of parole, despite their charges usually receiving less time and being more severe than federal, i.e. sex offenders in particular. The state of Texas has parole for many, many years, and the American public does not seem to be offended by that. Maybe this is just an American public's ignorance, but I feel this should be addressed. Federal inmates have to do 85% of our time, with the additional punishment of supervised release, versus state, which is often 10 to 50% at most with parole. I would like to state that my current cellie was charged with vehicular manslaughter in the state killing a man while drunk driving. He received a 10-year sentence and only did a few months due to parole after being sentenced. Meanwhile, I asked another undercover cop for some photos, was charged with attempted production of child pornography, and was sentenced to 22 years. 18 and a half I have to do if my good time remains intact. That, no matter how you slice it, is not justice, and I feel that the American public would not be outraged if I only did a paltry 11 years in prison for example, 50%. I appreciate your reading. Thank you for answering my question in your podcast. Interesting.
This has got a lot of stuff. We could actually do a podcast on this. But what I intended to communicate was that the system we have now in the federal system, it's been entrenched since 1984. So we're coming up on 40 years. And we've talked about the prison industrial complex and the prosecution industrial complex and the law enforcement industrial complex. The outcry back in 84 when this was done, and he may not have even been alive in 84 when this happened, I have no idea. But we had vastly different sentences in the federal judicial system. You had federal judges in Alabama who would impose very lengthy sentences for the exact same crime that someone out in the San Francisco would receive a probated sentence for. And in those days, half of the federal crimes ended up on probation. Now, I think it's somewhere that in the area of 8 to 10% actually get a probated sentence. If you could remember, Martha Stewart went to prison for lying to a federal investigator. She was so dangerous by telling that lie that she went to prison. So we had the public outcry that pushed this through Congress. Undoing something that's national policy is very difficult, particularly when it's been entrenched for 40 years. Just take a look at the First Step Act and how timid that was and how controversial it was and how it was even weakened after having finally achieved the bipartisan support of both parties. Then you had this renegade bunch of Republicans in the Senate that thought it went too far. So I'm judging based on what I know about the system. Now, he's probably right. If you took a poll of the American people and you actually talked about what we have people serving, how much time we have, and if we were able to have that intellectually honest conversation and we compared it to the various states, he's probably correct that people would be shocked. But the federal system doesn't have the constraints of a budget like the states do. The federal government doesn't have to balance its budget. That's not important to the American people anymore. We're happy to put it on the charge cards. Most states must balance their budget. In Texas, in particular, they don't have an income tax, if I'm recollecting correctly. And they believe in keeping low taxes. And they just got to where they couldn't afford their prisons. And then the federal courts stepped in as a result of litigation. And they had to reduce their population. And they've got a fairly lenient parole system. But when he says, all states, we don't have parole in New Mexico. Now, someone's going to write me and tell me I'm an idiot, because we do have a period of time we call parole. But in order to get to that period of time, you must serve all of your sentence, less your good time. And on violent offenses, we are mirrored exactly in the federal model. You get 15% for a serious violent offense, and then other offenses get 50%. And then that extinguishes your sentence, and then you go into a mandatory period of supervised release, but they label it parole so they can put it under the parole board. So you don't get out here until you serve, in many cases, 85% of your time. But I get his point. I agree with him that if you could have this intellectual discussion with the American people, and if you could keep the grandstanders out of it, who want to whip people into a frenzy with sound bites like they did with the First Step Act, you might could achieve that reform. But it's going to be tough. It's going to be very tough, and that's what I was trying to communicate.
What about the disparity in the amount of time that people receive, though, for miscellaneous different crimes?
Are you comparing this disparity between the state and the federal system? Because there's no comparison.
No, he's talking about, and I don't know if, so he's talking about, he got fed time for distribution, and then he's talking about somebody that had vehicular manslaughter. And went home after like 3 years or whatever.
Well, obviously the cellie he's talking about is in federal custody with him for something else. But he's talking about that cellie got released on parole after doing a small fraction of the time for vehicular homicide. But that has nothing to do with the federal system. vehicular homicide would not likely even be a federal crime because you'd have to do, I mean, most of these crimes that people complain about, they're state crimes. There's no federal jurisdiction. So I'm quite certain he's talking about somebody who ultimately ended up in federal prison for something else.
Okay. And then, all right, well, this
But
one is
he but
long.
he
I'm
is but he but he is making one point that the crime of which of his conviction for the photos is that 22 years is so extreme that if you ask the average person that, but see, it's all about how you ask the question. If you ask the person, should a prison sentence of 22 years be imposed for possession of photos of minors, the average person would say no. But if you ask the question, should 22 years be imposed for exploitation of children? Now remember, all you did is change the term from exploitation, from pictures to exploitation, and from minors to children, and you would get a whole different reaction on that same question. 22 years would seem
Yeah.
like just about the right amount of time if you said exploitation of children.
Sure. Yeah, terms matter in this case a lot, don't they?
Yep, and I would dare say that a lot of people who are serving these sentences right now, these long sentences, before they got into trouble, and me included, if you
Sure.
had posed the question that way, I would have said, well, of course, people who exploit children should be punished with significant penalties. I would have said that. Wouldn't you have?
I believe I would have for sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, then I guess this is the hate mail for me, which I'm going to get in trouble for saying it's hate mail to me because the person said that he wasn't sending. And I was saying all this stuff. I have a tendency to exaggerate, Larry. I don't know if you've noticed this, maybe.
No, I could not have ever thought of that.
Begins, Dear RMP, Registry Matters Podcast. Am I wrong? It's happened before, but I don't feel wrong. I feel the one wronged. It's so frustrating. You know it. I know it. Now, I find myself on the wrong side of friendship. Maybe it was mutual. Perhaps it stemmed from my fears and insecurities. But I don't like it, and I'm left vulnerable to too much scrutiny or in worse. Instead, I want to help. I wish to be part of the solution, not a hindrance. But how? How can I help? Registry Matters, episode 164, approximately 33 minutes and 57 seconds. The person who wrote this is going to get a copy of this transcript. That person was me. My efforts are page 5, and Andy said that would be me, some level of hate mail. I am the subject matter of scorn and the waste of valuable resources. Where did I go wrong? A year ago, I kept writing to Narsal about what it is I can do, asking what it is they are working on, but mostly I was begging for communication. For a year, I've wanted to help them. All they have to do is tell me what they need, and I want to help them. For a year, I have written, donated, read the digest, sought our state's affiliates, who never responded to any of my mail, reached out and asked over and over, only be told my potential limitations. Hate mail? I never wanted it to be. Yes, I spoke out of vexation, maybe spewed to an extent. And yes, I questioned their leadership, because as I see it, communication is the foundation of leadership. I have so much to offer, and I've even tried to assist in picking up the slack for them. I deeply feel as if I can be very useful, but now I feel chagrin. Instead of you guys doing more important things, you're chastising my petulance. So for that, I'm sorry. Can I make it up by subscribing? Seriously, I'm glad you reached out to me. Is there something I could do for you? My love, much love, Mr. Trent. Wow, is this where I'm supposed to be Brandon?
Well, not yet, but yeah, she needs
Okay.
to be getting ready. So, what I was going to focus on was the writing to the states, and I'd like for the writer to understand and everybody to understand that when we talk about the states, we're talking about people who are working full-time jobs. The funding is not there to have an organization that's staffed with individuals who are sitting around ready
Yeah.
to respond via mail. In every state that has any level of organization, almost all of them work full-time jobs. The executive director of NARSL is also the equivalent head of the state that she lives in, and she works a full-time job, and she d does the executive director for the state and the national organization. And the states, that they just don't have the resources to respond to the mail. And as we said in the letters that we've sent to him, we've heard these offers before, and it's just hard to integrate people in. But we're going to bring on Brenda again a second time because she has written a very elaborate response that will probably be published in the newsletter with some edits. But in terms of what her idea is in terms of how to get people involved in prison. So let's see if we can bring Brenda on now.
I've been trying to reach her. We might have to vamp for a few minutes. Brenda, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, sweet. Okay. I kept trying to ask if you were ready. Welcome back. You are the executive director, as Larry just more or less introduced you, the executive director of NARSAL, and you're also the executive director of your Maryland affiliate named FAIR, correct?
Yeah, so he's I was looking at Mr. Trent's letter earlier and tried to make another response. He brings up some really good points about, wanting to help and wanting responses. Larry is absolutely right. Most of us, I think I would say legitimately that you're not going to find too many other advocacy organizations around, definitely not in this field, that send responses at all. And it's not because we don't love you. It's not because we think you're useless. We simply don't have the time. We're trying to deal with, dealing with legislation, that kind of thing. And stopping and writing letters takes up what little time we have available, because we are, in fact, working or have family obligations, et cetera, et cetera. What I did respond to Mr. Trent about in particular, though, was, he has all these ideas and he wants to help. And we get this a lot, both inside and outside. And my response is, your ideas are great. What can you do? You personally, if you can come to us and say, I am ready to do these things to make a project happen, I will provide you all the support I can possibly provide. I won't just say an attaboy. I'll help advertise it, et cetera. But just coming to me with an idea and say, y'all ought to be doing such and so or such and so to fix the world, that doesn't help me at all. We've already got a list a mile long of things that we know we ought to be doing. And if we had a dollar for every time somebody came to us and said, here's this wonderful idea, we'd be filing so many lawsuits. Oh my gosh, we'd be solving all kinds of problems. So, but we need people to do things. So wherever you are, in prison, outside of prison, if you've got a great idea, tell me what you are going to do to make that idea happen. Because that's what we need, is people doing stuff. So I'll get down off my stump speech.
So, well, I had written, and one of the letters that NARSAL sent, I had a hand in writing it, and I tried to outline what we do in terms of our functions and how it would be very difficult for people in prison to do that. I mean, you don't have access to the internet largely. You don't have access to the telephone to make phone calls to lawmakers. In all likelihood, you don't have relationships. But now, if he does have relationships with lawmakers, and I'm talking about not knowing their name, that's not a relationship, but actually having personal relationships where his name is important, then that could be significant. But he needs to tell us what it is he can do within the confines of what of where he's finds himself. Generally speaking, they do not allow prisoners to leave their prison and go to their capitals to lobby and to speak on behalf or in opposition to bills. So, like on the things that we're currently doing at NARSAL, I don't see how an inmate behind bars can fit in, but we would love to have family members. If he could rally the family members out there to be more involved, I mean, the bottom line, folks, what we need is we need a whole lot more money, and that money is not everything, but it certainly is a big part of it because you can hire people, and you have access that you don't have without money. We need lobbyists. We need boots. These people cost money. Yeah, lobbying is a profession. And it requires a lot of expertise and relationship building. And wining and dining people to build relationships takes time and money. So I would like to hear more, but yes, we're probably going to turn that into a article for the newsletter so that everyone can see what we have said in the context of this communication, because there has to be more that feel frustrated that they can't do anything. So,
Brenda,
well,
anything else, or are we?
Yeah, I
Nothing
really
else,
appreciate
Dan.
I really appreciate you coming on. I really appreciate the effort you put into the letter.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I do think one of the folks in chat is mentioning, unlike the writer of this letter, who feels like he's got all kinds of things to offer, I also get a lot of people who say, "I don't know what to do. I just feel helpless." And yes, yeah, so we kind of have that other extreme. Again, if you got the funds are always good, and you will not be helpless, and you will be contributing. If you don't have funds, there can often be at least small things that you can do. You can get involved in contacting lawmakers when bills are being heard. There's a number of they seem little, but they add up. So just check in with us at NARSAW, and we'll find a way that gets you involved either at the national or at the state level.
I would like to chime in if that would be okay.
Sure.
When I first found NARSAL, I felt exactly as the person in chat field says. My biggest issue is I feel so helpless in trying to help. I call it lurked. I hung out. I participated in the phone calls and got new email stuff. And I was like, what could I do? And I have a particular set of skills, and I offered those and got in touch with Brenda and others at the time to then figure out how I could offer whatever. But I started donating money, but then offering my time and supporting and being a cheerleader on the sidelines. I mean, that means a lot too, is participating when we have calls and 10 people show up versus 200 people. Like, the 200 is a little bit more inspiring.
Absolutely, and you've been there with us on a lot of the development of what used to be the NARSAL in Action, and then we transitioned to doing this weekly podcast. And again, that's your skill set that you're contributing to help make this possible. We're getting information out weekly now, and we've tried to integrate it into what NARSAL does so that people can get. Who would have ever thought of distributing the podcast into the prisons?
Right.
It's like there's an
That's your brain.
additional source. Now, it's a very limited circulation list right now, but I do believe that that list is going to grow over time when people realize that we exist.
And then just to sort of complete the thought, the individual's asking about the state he's in, and Brenda is replying to him in chat as we are speaking, and says there are two groups in his state. He's like, there are? And nothing against the individual, but the
It could be
resources
hard to
are
find them. I'm
likely,
sorry.
sure. But doing searching in this particular case around the NARSAL site, I think you would find them. Not necessarily saying that a Google search would get you there. I'm saying that digging around, or even emailing or asking someone on the default list, communications at narsal.org, like, that information
Exactly.
would get distributed about.
Yeah, the way to you can go on our site and just do contact us and ask. There is a list of our contacts, like a list of our affiliates, but there are often people in other states where we don't list them online. Like if it's just an individual or a small group, we don't put their information up online for obvious reasons. But if you do the contact form, our contact people will definitely get you in touch with people in the state. So
Well,
reach out, reach out.
thank you for joining us again.
You're welcome.
So, all righty.
Larry, you selected, it turns out to be four miscellaneous clips that we're going to play. Do you want to set up the first one with the former president, like from 100 years ago?
Yeah, this former president Harry Truman talking about the importance of not of making sure the Constitution applies to everyone. In the context, it was pre-civil rights, when Harry Truman was one of those courageous guys that said that colored people, as they were referred to in that era, deserved to be treated equally. And so this is old give 'em hell, Harry.
All right, let's see. Hopefully this works.
I talked about Roosevelt and the New Deal and how it ought to be supported and Democratic achievements in Congress, and I didn't blow my own horn, didn't have to. People caught on. And I talked about civil rights. That was in Sedalia, Missouri. and I was talking to nothing but white faces, and a good number of them were Klan members, and I said that I believed in the brotherhood of man. And I didn't mean just white men, but the brotherhood of all men. And I told them that I believed in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and that if any class or race could be pushed down below the rest in political and civil rights, well, then so could any other class or race when the time came. And I told them it was their duty to see to it that the colored in their locality got increased opportunities to exercise their rights as free men. You see, if you believe in the Constitution, well, then everybody's got to have their rights, and that means everybody, and it doesn't matter a damn who they are or what color they are. And if you start making exceptions, well, then you just might as well not have a Constitution at all. You don't play fast and loose with that.
He said, don't give a damn, Larry.
Yeah, he was known for his colorful language in that era, but the relevant part is about the Constitution. When we start playing with the Constitution and saying that if it saves one, we're on that slippery slope that old Harry feared. The Constitution applies to everybody. You don't take a poll on the Constitution. So I set that up because I'm bringing Harry back in future episodes.
Ooh, and those are the fireside chats? Is that what that was?
No, that was just him reminiscing about his president, his political career, and including his presidency. But yeah, he was just talking.
Okay.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Do you want to set up the next one?
Oh, the next one is about, I kept it short. It's to where we can talk about legislative process and one of the tools of the legislative process. You're getting to watch a tool being used right now. So roll the clip.
At $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill is advancing in the Senate after a tie-breaking vote by the vice president. But there are new hurdles to tell you about. Peter Alexander explains.
The vice president votes in the affirmative.
Tonight, after Vice President Kamala Harris cast the tie-breaking vote to advance the COVID relief bill in the Senate, Republican Ron Johnson, in a last-ditch effort to delay its passage, forcing the clerk to read all 628 pages.
Section 1, short title. Section 2, table of contents.
Senate Democrats mocking the move.
And if the senator from Wisconsin wants to read it, let everybody listen, because it has overwhelming support.
But after President Biden signed off on changes that would send direct payments to fewer Americans, individuals making more than $80,000 and couples earning more than $160,000 will now not get a check. Some progressive Democrats complain that compromise is a mistake.
Is it really worth saving 0.05% to have less checks go out? This doesn't make much sense to me.
Still, Republicans argue it's too expensive.
Count me out for a $1.9 trillion spin fest. Unrelated to COVID in a partisan fashion. This is everything President Biden said he wouldn't do.
At this pace, it'll take the Senate clerks 15 hours to finish reading the bill, but Democrats vow that will not stop them from voting to pass the relief plan this week. Lester?
All right, Peter, thanks.
Tell me what you want out of that legislative process. Like, what are we going after there?
Okay, when you don't have the votes to kill something, and at this particular juncture, it doesn't look like the Republicans are going to have the votes to kill the $1.9 trillion stimulus. And I'm not opining one way or the other. This is all procedural. When you don't have the votes to kill that, then what you do is you use the tools you do have, which are parliamentary procedures, which we've talked about in the last couple of episodes. And the Republicans, since they realize that if a vote happens, they're going to lose the vote, they're using the parliamentary procedure of stalling. Now, they'll force the reading of the 600 pages. When that's done, then they'll offer amendments, which will all be voted down on a party line vote. There'll be 50-50 votes in all likelihood on all the amendments. And they'll do that till they exhaust themselves with amendments. These are all permissible parliamentary moves. There's nothing illegal about them. And people that are watching this take place, they'll say, well, it's all crooked politicians. No, it's not. When you're using the system, when you don't have the votes, you're doing what you can to try to stop the train. They don't know, but once something large might happen that might sway public opinion against the Democrats on the stimulus. I don't know what it could be right now. But right now, the Democratic proposal that passed the House is now in the Senate, has broad public support. I imagine it's because all the free money is going to be handed out, you know, the $1,400
payment. 65% support.
And I would imagine that is one of the reasons for the broad support. I mean, who doesn't support free money? But you don't know if something would change that. And like I say, I can't conceive of what that would be right now. But as long as you stall, you have the hope that something can change the dynamics. What would happen, for example, if one of the Democratic senators, you know, they seem to have a propensity to die in airplane crashes? What would happen if a Democratic senator died in an airplane crash?
Well, especially if it was in a Republican state, then the Republican governor would.
Right. Absolutely.
So a Republican would get appointed, and then it would be a 51-49, and that would be then, whatchamadooky, Turtlehead, he would become the majority leader again.
Yeah, so now, and that's a brilliant comeback on you, because that's exactly what I was getting at. Is if a Republican governor says they are allowed to appoint senators, that what would happen? All of a sudden, you've got a new ballgame. So what you do when you're in the minority is you use the tools you have to advance your agenda, and their agenda is to stop Biden's agenda. Pure and simple.
Yeah.
And like I say, I don't want to get into which way we're leaning on that, but just understand these are valid parliamentary tools, and that's what that clip was for. That's what the Republicans are doing, and that's all they can do.
And the next one, you want to talk about something going on in New York.
Yeah, this is our beloved governor of New York, who's had some political issues arise recently, and I think the clip will set it up nicely.
Okay, hopefully I don't have any tech meltdowns.
Thanks. Two of the women who have accused New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment are speaking out. With more, here's Ann Thompson.
A day after Andrew Cuomo tried to extinguish the scandal engulfing him.
I feel awful about it. And frankly, I am embarrassed by it.
Two of the three women accusing the New York governor of sexual harassment speak out, both former employees.
Without explicitly saying it, he implied to me that I was old enough for him and he was lonely.
25-year-old Charlotte Bennett was an executive assistant to Cuomo. In June, she says Cuomo asked her a series of intimate questions, including whether she had ever been with an older man.
I thought, he's trying to sleep with me. The governor's trying to sleep with me.
All right.
Okay, so I think if you've been a regular listener for a while, I don't think anybody would say that I'm a great fan of Andrew Cuomo. And I did like Mario, the father, but I've not been enamored by him. But I set this up because we stopped at her accusation. Can you imagine that? A person, two adults, and he said comments that suggested he thought that she was attractive. Should that disqualify him from holding that office?
Should we not hold the individual to a higher standard?
Of course we should. The voters absolutely should. But that's what we have elections for. But there's no crime being alleged. She said that the comments that he made led her to believe that he wanted to sleep with her. Now, I doubt he actually wanted to sleep I'm thinking.
That's a euphemism. That, I think, is the definition of euphemism.
So, but that's the extent. She did not say that he threatened me with demotion, with termination, or anything else. Her particular allegations are that he found her attractive. Now, I'm just wondering, what kind of society can we live in where humans will not ever find another human attractive?
I wonder, where does the line get crossed? I was having a minor conversation with someone, just a short conversation before we started recording about this subject. And where does the line get crossed between, especially because he's a pretty powerful person, even like as a national stage set. I mean, New York's the second most populated state. He would be a pretty powerful person as being the governor. That sets up a very large power differential between him and whomever he is flirting with. And where does it become workplace harassment?
Well, that's what the investigation is going to reveal. If there was any quid pro quo, if there was any. But I'm not sitting here saying that I like that. I like to think when I was supervising workplaces, I tried to keep all the inappropriate stuff down. But I did recognize I was dealing with humans. And although I had a rigid policy and property management that my staff could not have relations with our tenants, I have no doubt that it probably occurred unbeknownst to me. And yeah. And should the governor be flirting with the staff and suggesting that he would like to have a romantic? Ideally, no. You probably shouldn't be doing that. There's no question about it. But does that disqualify him from being fit for office? Now, I personally don't like him. I do not think he has done enough for criminal justice reform. I think he's been absent the scene completely on his power, using his powers in terms of reducing prison population as a result of the pandemic. I think I could go on and on about where, but I'm focusing on this one thing. If the fact that you find an adult attractive disqualifies you, then we're in serious trouble. The investigation should go forward.
Where does the line get drawn between great job, it's really great to work with you, well, that's a really nice tie you're wearing today, or a nice blouse, to some other kind of, you know, pushing the line, where does it cross to, I'm really happy that I work from home. That's what I can really honestly say.
Well, I mean, I see
complicated and murky to navigate.
When I'm in public, I occasionally see a well-dressed guy. I still feel it's okay to tell the guy, you look really wonderful today. That suit is well coordinated. But I'm really hesitant to tell a woman anymore that you look good, because it seems like that translates into all of a sudden sexual harassment. You can't just admire the color coordination. And I mean, I saw the former Senator Claire McCaskill and from Missouri. Gee, coincidence with Harry Truman. She is a regular on Meet the Press on Sunday. A couple, three episodes ago, she had the most beautiful suit. She looked magnificent. She's as old as I am, if not older. But I thought, wow, she's a fantastic dresser. I wonder if you can actually say that to anybody anymore.
So. Yeah, I don't know. All right. So send hate mail to crackpot@registrymatters.co. And the final one, you want to set it up or just run it?
So the final one is about the police reform and at the U.S. And the U.S. Congress. And there's no intended partisanship here. This is merely a fact-finding demonstration. But we're going to show the clip about the proposal and what it would do. And then hopefully the screenshot materializes about how the votes broke down between the parties. So roll the tape.
The U.S. Senate will get a sweeping police reform bill named after George Floyd as Minneapolis braces for the most anticipated police murder trial in memory. Here's Gabe Gutierrez.
With tensions high in downtown Minneapolis, ahead of next week's jury selection for the murder trial of former officer Derek Chauvin, who knelt on George Floyd's neck, overnight, the U.S. House passed a police reform bill in Floyd's name.
What it signifies is, we have people that understand that what happened on that day was wrong.
Louisville, Kentucky banned no-knock warrants following Breonna Taylor's death. After Elijah McClain died, Colorado got rid of qualified immunity, a policy that made it harder to sue police officers. Banning both at the federal level is now part of the reform bill, along with banning chokeholds and creating nationwide databases of police misconduct.
And all right. And then I do, you asked for it, Larry. And how about that? Wait, not that. That. There what is the about? Vote tally. Well, I have the screenshot up for those watching YouTube for the votes of the yays and the nays in the House.
Okay. Well, if you look at that, the measure passed in the House with 219 Democratic votes and one Republican vote in favor. The opposition was two Democratic representatives voted no, and 210 Republicans voted no. So what that tells us is that these measures are perceived as being too radical for the Republican Party. And that's why when you mentioned that they had a proposal in the Georgia General Assembly, I said there's no way in the world that's going to pass the Georgia legislature because of
predominantly Republican.
That's correct. You'll never get that out of the Georgia General Assembly, not as it's currently made up today. The police would have too much sway over the Republican Party when it comes to law enforcement, and that clip we stopped prematurely, but that's fine. It made the point. The other point I was going to make where the clip stopped is that Mr. Floyd's brother was talking about that he shouldn't have to go through a trial. And nobody could feel worse, I don't think, than I would feel about my brother being deprived of oxygen and essentially it looks like a murder. But Mr. Chauvin is not required to plead guilty. He is entitled to a presumption of innocence. That's the accused. He's entitled to have a trial. He's entitled to assert any defense that's reasonable that his team wants to put on. And he's entitled to have that verdict read by a jury. And he owes you no obligation to plead guilty. But that was part of the clip where he said he shouldn't have to sit through that. I'm sorry, but that's our system. We have an adversarial system. The accused owes you no obligation to plead guilty.
And that would be the right to trial and all that good stuff and confrontation. That's where I was going. That's Eighth Amendment. Is that where the confrontation comes in?
You expect me to know the Constitution?
I kind of do, Larry. I mean, we talk about this particular one fairly frequently. I'm sure we're not going to talk about the 22nd, 3rd, and 7th Amendments are, but I'm pretty sure the Eighth Amendment is the... Confrontation clause.
Yeah, I never can keep those straight. I'm not a numbers guy. I can keep the first one straight. I think the second one, then I start getting lost.
The second one, you pretty much.
The fifth one,
the search and seizure. The third one is the weirdest one to me. It's the government cannot quarter soldiers in your house. I'm like, I don't think that one has ever been stomped on.
So, but yes, I disagree with Mr. Floyd's brother, but on those reforms. We're going to end up in the same situation in the Senate that it probably won't get out of the Senate because of the filibuster rule. And you're going to need 60 votes. And if the Republicans, if you can't win more votes, this was voted on last year when the Republicans controlled the Senate and they couldn't get but a few Republicans to support it. So you're going to end up with the same thing. It's going to die again in the Senate. So those of you out there who think that criminal justice reform is important, if you live in a state where you have Republican senators, lean on them and tell them you support these proposals. They need to hear from constituents. They need to hear loud and clear that these are reasonable proposals. Even Kentucky, after Breonna, even Kentucky, conservative Kentucky did it.
Yeah. And there was, there was another state. Was that Texas that said something? That was
Colorado.
After Colorado? Okay. Well, then never mind. I don't, wasn't that where... I remember some police incident shooting somebody, and they unfortunately kind of run all together at this point. I think that was one of almost like a not home invasion, but the police were responding to a call, I think.
So,
and it was a woman just in her house.
There's somebody I can't keep track of them. Let's go to the main event.
Very good. Very good. I guess I'll just start with these questions. So, you people put this case in called Lacey Stratford et al. Versus John Wetzel, Secretary, Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And I think it was released a couple weeks ago, back in sort of the beginning of February, and we're just now getting to talk to it. What does it have to do with us? And are you, maybe you're just bored, Larry?
I wouldn't say I'm bored at all. It's an important case for us.
Well, then why is it important for us?
Well, because it's a decision that deals with an important issue of people who are required to register being denied release, even though they've actually been approved for parole. So this case has been bobbing around for years, but the claims are that although they've been granted parole, their release from prison and placement into Department of Corrections operated halfway houses has been significantly delayed because of a policy considering community sensitivity to a criminal offense and making these placements. And that's what this case is about.
Is this done at the appellate level or is this in trial court?
Well, it has been up since it's been pending since 2016. The state has tried their best to extinguish this as a Pennsylvania case, but it's gone up on appeal, and the appellate court has kept the case alive. And so now we've got a decision on the merits through summary judgment. And it's really good stuff. Really good stuff.
Summary judgment, your favorite thing.
Well, in some cases, it works out okay. In this case, it appears to have done just what we needed.
All right. Well, and yeah, the way I read the opinion is it says that these plaintiffs, like all incarcerated individuals in Pennsylvania, are statutorily eligible for parole after serving their minimum sentence as fixed by their sentencing judge. Next, it stated that the Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole, the PBPP, say that 10 times fast, investigates all individuals eligible for parole. In deciding whether to grant parole, the PBPP considers several factors, including the nature and circumstances of the offense, the recommendations of the judge and prosecuting attorney, the character and background of the individual's conduct in prison and participation in treatment, the individual's physical and mental condition, and the individual's complete criminal record. The PBPP also considers the positive recommendations of the Department of Corrections, an individual's demonstrated motivation for success, and whether the individual has accepted responsibility for the offense committed. These all sound reasonable. So, Larry, where's your problem with this?
Well, that is actually the problem. And you spent a lot of time trying to pull all that out of the decision, but that's exactly that's what sunk the state. These people have already gone through this process of having all those considerations done before they were determined eligible for release. So one beef is individuals with sex offense classifications are subject to additional requirements as part of the parole process. Prior to being considered for parole, a PFR must complete a sex offender treatment program. At the time of parole consideration, the Pennsylvania Sex Offenders Assessment Board, consisting of psychiatrists, psychologists, and criminal justice experts, and behavior and treatment professionals, evaluates each PFR. When the PBPP grants parole, we should just say when the board grants parole, it's typically yes. with a condition that the individual have an approved home plan. And this approved home plan can be a personal approved residence or placement at a DOC operating halfway house. And due to difficulty in finding approved residences, obtaining sufficient money to cover rent and cost of living, most of them rely on placement at halfway house. And the halfway houses are not taking the PFRs because of community sensitivity. And that's what this case is all about.
So they are granted, isn't this almost like them being held past their sentence date then? Is that what this is?
No, they're eligible for parole, but they're giving them... Right? They're stalling their community reintegration because they don't have a place to go. But they've been, that's why that long question you had was so relevant, because between what you said and what I said about the additional steps that a PFR must go through, they've been vetted and vetted and vetted.
Right.
But yet they're still being restrained from being allowed to reintegrate after everyone has said this person is reasonably safe for release. They won't release them because of the heightened community sensitivity.
Larry, I'm getting the feeling that we talked about this like a million years ago, Has the policy related to PFRs changed during this case?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We've discussed this case before. And the policy regarding the community placement has evolved over the life of the case. In 2016, when the case was initiated, the policy treated parolees with a sex offense classification differently from other parolees. Under the policy at that time, PFRs who received a positive parole actions were precluded from community placement until they were within 24 months of their maximum sentence. Unlike other parolees without sex offense classifications who were placed upon receiving a positive parole action recommendation. So PFRs were regularly designated as hard to place, and they were rejected simply because of the community sensitivity. The parole authorities in Pennsylvania did not want the community correction centers to have too many of these kind of people.
My thoughts on Pennsylvania are that they don't have any sort of 1,000-foot kind of restrictions. So if they're granted parole, then what is the problem of putting them into a halfway house?
Well, it was the sensitivity of the community that they were worried about. They were going to have clustering.
Did they post flyers on people's doorsteps?
Well, the registry itself would pick the people up. If you had 14 PFRs on one halfway house, it would be easy to see the cluster right. when you went.
I see. And now we could then move over to equal protection, which is going to be like 13, 14, 15, something like that amendments. And I know you're not into numbers. How can they have two separate tracks for people that are PFRs versus not PFRs?
Well, that's what the court had trouble understanding. The court noted that although the parties offer competing views on whether the DLC's policy comports with the Equal Protection Clause, the court concludes, quote, it does not. The court held the DLC's policy of considering community sensitivity and delaying the release of parolees with a sex offense classification on that basis alone violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The court therefore granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, and they denied the DLC's motion, and they enjoined the DLC from continuing this unconstitutional practice, and that's on page 10 to 11 of the opinion.
I've heard you talk about different levels of judicial scrutiny many times, which is going to be rational basis and strict scrutiny, and I'm missing one of those.
Intermediate
and the one
scrutiny.
Oh, intermediate. Okay. And the one that's sticking to my brain is the rational basis test. And you said that this level of scrutiny is where the appellate court is most deferential to the challenge. What level of scrutiny was applied to this case?
Well, oddly enough, they struggled with it, and they concluded that the correct level of scrutiny, this judge concluded that was rational basis, but it didn't even pass the rational basis test, which is so deferential. The DLC asserted that it has a legitimate interest in assuring that no one particular CCC, Community Corrections Center, and surrounding community be required to house a disproportionate number of PFRs. The DLC claimed that without evidence that if it were released, PFRs without delay at the same pace as other classifications offenders, that the CCCs would be overburdened by PFRs, which in turn would overburden the communities where the CCCs are located. And the court didn't buy into that.
Yeah, I struggle with that one. Just rational basis, that's the bottom tier, because obviously strict would be the hardest one. So then rational basis has to be the bottom one, where you just have to figure out whether, does this even make sense before we try and challenge it at a constitutional level? Does this just even make sense? You're prejudging the people that just because they have a PFR type offense that they are inherently going to like spontaneously offend on people.
Well,
and that doesn't seem like that even fits.
Let's just go to the rational basis because it's so misunderstood. People think that rational basis means that what they're doing is rational because it says rational basis.
Sure.
It doesn't mean what they're actually doing is rational. It means what they hope to accomplish is a rational underlying motivation. So all they have to assert to pass the rational basis test is that this is what we would like the result to be. The courts don't get into determining if it's the most efficient, if there could be a better way of doing it. They don't redesign public policy. But they determine that a rational basis test applying to this particular situation, it doesn't pass that test because they didn't have the evidence to support what they were saying. I mean, they proffer all these reasons for why they're doing it, but they don't, they didn't have any evidence to support it.
And we need to get out of this one. What's the bottom line?
Well, the bottom line is we've got a great decision from a trial court, and as states typically do, they will likely appeal. But the court noted that the Department of Corrections has not proffered a legitimate justification for its policy of delaying release of PFRs to community correction centers after they receive a positive parole action, meaning that that board has granted them release, and that extra step that a PFR has to go through, all that has been taken into consideration. And they say, any consideration, this is a quote, of community sensitivity, which on the this record is merely private biases against PFRs, is not permissible. And I substituted PFRs for what the court said, where they said sex offenders, sure, for treating PFRs differently. As for the concerns with public safety, these considerations are misleading because PFRs seeking placement in a CCC, like all other offenders, have received a positive parole action and have received a termination that there was no reasonable indication that they may pose a risk to public safety and are subject to structures of Megan's Law as well as for the protection of the public. So this is a great decision. I hope they don't appeal, but I expect they likely will. And this will be tied up it's been going since 2016, so it may run another couple of years.
If we can use rational basis to jump over to the Georgia bill that the two knuckleheads representatives in some small county proposed, they were just, they didn't like that a level one person got off the registry, and they're trying to propose this as a law. They didn't have anything to back up what they were saying. They just didn't like it. They didn't have some level one, some cadre of level one offenders that went out and reoffended. They just had it that they didn't like it. Is that something that doesn't pass a rational basis if it were to go to court and enter into all that level? I know that it's assumed to be constitutional when it's signed in, but if it were to make it to court, is that something that doesn't pass a rational test?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm going to need some time to cogitate on that one. So the Georgia Assembly hypothetically might pass the proposal because and it's not uncommon. States have passed laws that limit people's ability to get off. New York would be a good example. You know, their registry was 10 years, and they added another 10-year extension onto it. And so if Georgia tightens their eligibility for getting off of that petition process, that's an interesting question, because do you have to have a petition for removal process? Absolutely not. At least I'm not aware of any case law that requires, and that's what we should work towards, that to keep someone on the shaming list, it has to be some due process. But if Georgia makes it more difficult and they increase the minimum amount of time before you can apply, can they do that without any evidence? We need to think about that. That may be a cause of action. You may have invented a new claim that has never been previously asserted.
Go me. I need to press the button that says applause, but I don't have one. Hey, wait, I'll try this one. There. And you didn't laugh.
I didn't hear any applause.
Oh, no, I don't have applause. It just said I'm trying to win the game.
Oh, I didn't hear that one either.
Oh, it didn't come over. I'll try again.
Trying to win the game.
There.
That is what we're in the business of doing. We're trying to win the game, folks.
Interesting. That's super interesting. They listed all of those things. Basically, people have been given parole by the parole board, yet they can't get into housing, so then they're just denied. And then, to me, that sounds like they're detained past. I know parole isn't any sort of guarantee. That's totally a privilege, so they're not being held past their maximum release date, but they're being held up to because, well, quote unquote, they don't have a place to stay.
I think they might be actually held past their release date if they've been granted parole, and you would normally be integrated into a state facility if you don't have your own facility, which is what it sounds like they do in Pennsylvania, then the fact that they are adding an additional layer of community sensitivity, so we don't want too many of this kind in the community, that sounds like to me that you're actually being held in prison past your release date, and it sounds like that's what the court agreed with.
Right. Interesting. Oh, that's super interesting. And again, this is only at the state level, just trying to see where it would apply outside of PA. This isn't any sort of appellate level This is just within PA itself?
Well, it has been up to appeal before. The state tried to extinguish by making modifications to the policy, and they tried to extinguish the claim several times. So it's already been up on appeal, and I didn't have the time to do all the work on the previous on what the appellate court has decided. But it very well could go back on appeal again, because the state is not going to want to have to make these changes. They're not going, I hate to tell you, they're not going to want to say, oh, well, we've had this wrong all along. And we'll get these people out of prison as quickly as possible. So if they have not already had the door shut on the previous appeal that went up, they're likely to appeal again. So we will be staying tuned and probably have our Pennsylvania people come in. And once they make their decision on whether they're going to appeal, we can have Teresa come in and fill us in with additional detail.
Fantastic. All right, man. Anything else? We had a handful of articles, but we are already way past an hour, and we should shut it down pretty soon.
I think we should just close down because we've got a time limit here now of 1 hour and 7 minutes.
Oh, well, we're like 4 minutes past it. All right. Well, we do have a new patron. Jason came on board. Thank you, Jason. That is super awesome that you came on to be one of our Registry Matters patrons. We really love all of the listeners that we have, and the patrons help keep this whole shebang going and going and going, and they're really special people to me. Otherwise, you can head over to registrymatters.co and get show notes and get the podcast and links and places everywhere. Voicemail is 747-227-4477, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, I just mentioned it, go over to patreon.com/registrymatters, sign up for just as little as a dollar a month, and it goes a long way to help show that the podcast is appreciated by all you people.
What is anything this, else, you Larry? People? What is this, you people
You
stuff?
People. I don't even think it came, I think it came before you learned me of where it came from, because, hang on.
Now, I don't have to tell you who gets hurt first when this sort of thing happens, do I? Your people do.
And who is
your
that?
Your people do. I know that. You know that.
That's Ross Perot, the former independent candidate for president in 1992. He was the head of a company called, I think it was like EDS, the Electronic Data Systems or something. But yeah,
correct.
He was
EDS Corp. And one of the first billionaires that I heard about.
Yep, he was a Looney Tune, but that seems to run in the family of when people get rich, they somehow go nuts.
I've heard of this. Well, cool, man. As always, Larry, you're the bomb, and I appreciate it, and I know our listeners appreciate it too, so give a big round of applause for Larry. And with that, I will I'll see if I can't find somebody else for next week, but otherwise, if you'll mark off your calendar, maybe we'll have you back next week too.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Take care, buddy. Yep.
Good night.
Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.